podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right. First thing I'm gonna do is screw Yanni over here because I. Did you bring my perch flies?
No.
All right, Yanni. If anyone's been following this, Yanni will not make me my perch flies because he won't. I won't do any promotion for his T-shirt company. So I will not talk about the striking red Hunt to Eat Meat Eater collaboration T-shirt that he's wearing right now.
Because
he will not.
What's a stinker about our hunting fans and our purchasers and buyers is that, you know, we make these colors thinking like, man, someone's gonna break out of the mold of blue, gray, and white, and we've sold probably almost 100-to-1 blue to red T-shirts.
People like blue. Are you plugging your T-shirt company right now?
No. I'm talking about just buyers.
The thing about the perch fly that's really driving me nuts is like I put a picture up of the perch fly. And people are like, oh, yeah, it's such an easy tie, you know. But that's not the point. The point is that 20 months ago, I asked you to do a small favor, and you refused to do it.
What size hook do you want them on?
I'll have to show you. Right there. Well, I'll show you in a minute. I don't know. Unlike most people who've been fishing for a long time, I can't tell you. I can't look at a hook and tell you. I just know it when I see it. But that's not what I want to talk about. There's a thing I want to talk about. There's a main thing we're going to talk about, and there's a thing I'm going to talk about real quickly before the main thing. And then I already have a segue that's amazing how I'm going to get from the one to the other. It's going to be like you're reading a David Foster Wallace thing when I hit my segue. You'll see in a minute. The first thing I was going to talk about is Ryan Callahan's here. Cal, what was your favorite thing about the week you just spent at our fish shack? Like your favorite thing that I did.
Little wrinkle.
I went up to Steve's fish shack in Alaska, and it was so overwhelmingly awesome. I'm having a hard time picking something out, but I loved the harpooning of halibut next to the boat.
Yeah, when we get a big halibut up, because we're fishing small boats.
Really 16, small.
16-foot skiff and an 18-foot skiff.
Like, I would think people were looking at us funny when they're putting by us in their purse seiners and stuff out there.
Yeah, and when you get a big fish in a little boat, it's different than a big fish in a big boat. So what we'll do is we get them up, and then we'll harpoon them. And then sometimes kind of hog tie them, and then drag them up into the boat. It's fun.
Incredibly fun.
Explain that, how that harpoon works.
It's like a detachable head on it. So what I did is I went down to Home Depot. I mean, you can buy them, but I went down to Home Depot and bought a hoe handle, like a replacement handle for a garden hoe, and drilled it out and put a piece of stainless steel stainless steel rod in there. And then there's a detachable head you buy where the detachable head slips over the stainless steel shaft, and that's connected to a cable, and then you run the cable to a rope and the rope to a buoy. So when you stick the fish in the gill cover, you pass through the fish, the detachable head comes off and forms like a toggle on the other side if you get a clean pass through, and then you just throw the buoy overboard.
And you watch that buoy kind of go honk.
Yeah,
in the water.
A good fish will pull the buoy. The buoy's about the size of a beach ball, small beach ball.
We didn't see the buoy go under, but we had the one kind of.
Yeah, 120 pound halibut will take that buoy way down, you know. And we've had it too where you stick them with the harpoon and the rod comes undone, like the hook comes out. And then, you know, you can disconnect from the anchor line and go chase the buoy and get the fish.
It's nice because it pins those gills down.
Yeah.
And it just, you have all this chaos of this thing coming up to the boat, and there's rods and and sharp hooks and stuff flying around, and then
and lots of dudes yelling, "Reel, reel, reel!"
giving advice. If you hit the fish in the gill cover and get like a good pass through, then what you can do is you just once you get the fish out of the boat, he's if you hit him in the gill and his gills are bleeding, they'll kind of bleed him out anyways. But then if he's big, you can bleed him, and then take the cable and pull it tight and hog tie it around his tail so he's curled up. Then drag him in the boat and he doesn't go bananas in the boat.
And the whole halibut, it was amazing because, like, the bleeding process, it's, like, almost, like, if you were to, I don't know, it's a ton of blood. Like, major artery just, I mean, gives big squirt. And then the intestines on a...
You can case sausage.
Yeah, it looks like you can
Kelly make sausage. Talking about making sausage casings out of halibut.
I've never seen intestines on a fish. Like, discernible intestines. It was... I love the whole thing.
We opened up a halibut stomach. Were you there for that? We opened up a halibut stomach, and it had a seabird in it.
Yeah, I was there for that.
A bird?
Yeah.
You caught a seabird, a diver.
It was. Like a duck. I mean, yeah, we were doing serious. Awesome.
Then you opened
At first, I thought he had a porcupine because it was kind of it was digested partially. But then I realized I was just looking at the bases of the feathers, which seemed, yeah. So however the hell he come into that. Either it died and sank, or he grabbed it when it was down fishing. Pulled a big chunk of squid out of one, a lot of fish bones, found a rockfish otolith in one's gut. And then what else? We got
old bait,
a lot of old bait, a lot of salmon bellies. We'll take on pink salmon. You're allowed to use the belly strip of a pink salmon. So we use pink salmon bellies. Hooligans. My brother Danny dipped up a bunch of hooligans in the 20-mile river. They run in the spring. So salt the hooligans down and use, people call them candlefish. It's a very oily fish. And
all amazing information. However, it will be gone because nobody wants to keep a journal up there. Like, this is all good stuff, I think. Like, it will improve the fishing game.
Yeah, but what I'm going to do, though, is I want to start take one of our charts and start putting a pin at all known halibut locations, all known yellow eye, and all known lingcod locations. So we also dove. One day we went out on we had a good low tide. You know, lunar cycles drive the tides, but there's also a big influence from the sun. So when the sun and the moon are aligned right, you can get very deep tides. And they're normal. So you're like, tides start at sea level. A high tide would be plus 20. So 20 feet above sea level. But a big low tide is only like minus 4 or minus 5. We went out at a minus 3 tide and dove for scallops, rock scallops and cucumbers. And Cal was the boat tender for that. We got a mountain of sea cucumbers.
Yeah, you got to Google these things, and they look like this really...
It looks like a diseased male member.
Seriously diseased.
Yeah, like bad.
And they come
on an acid trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you had a diseased male member and looked at it while tripping...
Sign me up.
That was the voice of Hillary Hutchinson. I want to do my thing, though. My transition. So, check it out. So, my fish shack's on the beach. Okay? Someone can come walking down the beach in front of my fish shack, legally. I have no right to go yell at him. Right?
Correct.
That's why we're going to talk about access. Huh?
Nice.
You guys like that?
Mm.
As though dealing poker, we got 5 people here. I'm dealing now to you, so introduce yourself, please.
Lantani, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers.
That's it?
Well, what else? I mean, like,
father of two?
Like, hot tub and sushi anytime. Long walks on the beach.
I do have 2 young kids, an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. Spent a lot of time outdoors. Just got back from the Bob Marshall. Spent my 13th wedding anniversary in the Bob Marshall this weekend.
Really?
I did. And just us two.
You haven't done that 13 times in a row, have you?
No, that's 3 years in a row.
Do you know my brother renews his vow every anniversary?
Weird. I don't know.
He's been married 2 years, so.
Okay, well.
That's gonna.
Probably
she puts the dress back on, and they redo the vows. Well,
I mean, really? That's what they like to do. That's what they like to do, right?
You know what's cool about where he got married? He got married on his wife's ranch or family's ranch. Been there for a few generations, and they got a family plot where the grandparents and stuff.
Everybody's buried.
Yeah, they got married right there.
Yeah, that's cool.
So you can see why they go back up there.
Oh, for sure.
Where'd you go in the Bob?
We went in just outside of Sealy, not Pyramid Pass and not Morrell Falls, but somewhere close.
Gotcha.
And went into this lake up on top. It's about 3.5 miles, and you get 3,500 feet of elevation in that 3.5 miles. So
did you get any halibut back in there?
We got four of them with a gaff. It's so hard to carry. No, we hammered the cutthroats, man.
Really?
And the first lake that we stayed at was dead. It had a bunch of leeches in it, no fish. And you popped into this one that had...
Like how bad leeches? Like big leeches?
Like big ones, like that big.
Wow, you think there would be fish because of that.
That's what I think. When we saw them, like all these leeches are out in the open, just like swimming around. And so that was a red flag that there was no fish in there. And then we stayed right there.
Because they'll parasite on the fish and kill them?
No, the fish will eat them.
They wouldn't be just swimming around.
Yeah, saying there's no fish there because all the bait's there.
No, what I'm saying is if bait's being that obvious, means that there's no fish.
They've got full
there.
Rain. Bait, it's like bait land.
Right.
I got you.
So we didn't, there was no fish there, but there was a mile and a half away, there was an awesome little lake where we had a waterfall that was about 40 feet coming off this sheer kind of rock face. And at that inlet, it was just game on. And my wife doesn't fly fish that much. And she just had a ball, and she looked over at me at one point. She's like, "You may make a fisherman out of me at some point."
Caught a message.
Did you guys bring your kids?
No. They stayed with mother-in-law, so we had us two for 3 days, no cell phones.
Really?
And like there was actually some romance, and we could have adult conversations.
She's like, "You're the best fisherman ever."
Yeah, there it is. There it is.
My provider at this lake.
Grizzly bear tracks, like 40 yards from camp.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean they were not there when you showed up and were there in a day or two?
No, they were there. Like they were probably like a day old when we got there, which was the way I'd like to see them.
Good.
Yeah.
I like to see them with the bear still in it.
Well, I like seeing bears, but not close.
Yeah. All right. Man, we saw some cool bears feeding. We were down fishing Silvers one night last week, and there's 5 or 6 bears in there.
Incredible.
Would they take turns?
Because
he's staking out this little riffle. And when a fish would come up the riffle, he grabbed it and he hauled it up in the bushes to eat it. And his buddy, who was just like basically taking a bath.
Yeah.
Like cool, it was hot. And his buddy's like cooling off in the pool. And he's like, "Oh, my turn." And runs over to the riffle.
One to grab a fish, head in the woods. Next one would come to the riffle. And it was, we were sitting in a canoe. And you could take my fly rod and basically touch each bank from sitting in the canoe. So it was really tight. And there were ultimately six black bears up there feeding.
My kid didn't like it.
Because of the bears?
He kept thinking the bears were going to get him.
He was a little nervous, but at the end of the day, he's like, best day ever. Yeah. You know, it was great.
I told him, I'm in charge of being worried about bears. I'll tell you when it's time to worry about bears. And these bears have a lot on their mind besides you.
Who's been around more bears? Me or you? You. Yeah, that was cute. That was fun.
Next.
My name's Hillary. Hillary Hutchison, and I live in Northwest Montana.
Mother of
two hooligans, teenagers, 12 and 14.
I don't know why I'm bringing up who's got kids. It's like, I don't know.
No, it's good to know. I mean, it's important. It's all part of it. You mean, you do what you do for yourself, but also for them, and hope they enjoy it too at some point. And if they don't, you know, now, you hope they will.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's important. It's good to ask, especially if you have 3 kids. That's kind of the first thing you ask, right?
Yeah. Then you can complain about your kids with other people.
Yeah. Yeah, you start saying, "Well, does your kid eat dirt?" No, neither does mine, I swear.
We had breakfast this morning. There was no complaining about kids at all.
Yeah, none.
So run down, you know, lay on me kind of your professional scope, your professional purview. It's not a word I use very often.
Well, I don't even know if it was used properly, but I'm going to go with it. Yeah, no, so I'm a fly fishing guide in Northwest Montana. I guide for Glacier Anglers. I got to work with Cal over here back in the day.
Oh, is that right? You guys work together?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep. And
but it's your busy season right now, right?
It is a busy season, yeah, for sure. But I'm kind of making the rounds doing some other things right now, even though it's a busy season. I've been there for a really long time. And so now I've kind of tried to make use of that time in other ways and trying to balance it a little bit. But like I just got back from Washington, D.C. to talk about how climate change is affecting our fishery.
Gotcha.
And so right now in Montana, across Montana, you know, we're in hoot owl conditions. You can't fish after 2 p.m. The river's too low, too hot, too dry. It's really difficult on the fish. And so, you know, seeing a lot of different things happen around Montana. And, you know, we're talking about access. That's kind of one of them. But so I try to, you know, squeeze some other things in there during my busy season. I have a trip tomorrow. I got to be there 6 a.m. Get ready for a full day.
You're guiding
fish
tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gotcha. Yep. Unless this delays me.
What are you guys going to go after tomorrow?
Tomorrow, what are we fishing for?
Yeah, like what will you target?
Yeah, so our fishery is just cutties. There's bullies in there. The bullies are actually doing better this year than I thought they would be. But mostly cutthroat is kind of what we're fishing for. Yeah, it's
good, man. Native trout, man. Mm-hmm. God, I get sick of non-native trout.
Yeah, no, it's that's what people come there for. Right now, you know, it's in West Glacier. People are coming to see the last of the glaciers, but they're also coming to fish for native West Slope cutthroat trout. It's great. And now people are kind of at the point that they can say it by name. Like a lot of times it used to be back in the day, people would get on your boat and they're like, so what are we fishing for today? You know, now it's like destination fishery. They know what they're coming for because it's...
They want to see cuts
and
bull trout.
They want to see it. They want to catch them. And
I caught my first bull trout with that guy right there.
Wow. You got lucky. Cal got lucky.
he kind of showed me how to do it, man. All right, Cal, introduce yourself. Are you satisfied with your introduction?
But you do
a TV show.
Yeah, I have a television show.
And you got to say the fly shop, too.
Yeah, and I got a fly shop.
You own a fly shop?
I do, yeah. Yeah, I own a fly shop in my town. I'll talk about the fly shop first because it's kind of my favorite right now.
You guys sell harpoon rigs down there?
About to. And I took copious notes. Now I know how to make them. I don't have a Home Depot nearby, but I know a bunch of hoes.
Plenty of hoes nearby.
Train Depot.
The fly shop is called Larry's Fly and Supply. It's called that. It's for Hillary, but it's Larys. But the reason it's called that is this is the town I grew up in where my shop is. And when I was a kid in high school in sports, we put our first name on the back of our jerseys one year. And somebody made a mistake at the printer and put a space in between the H-I and L-A-R-Y. So I went running out in the corner and said, "Hi, Larry." So all the old guys who come into my shop now, they walk into the shop and they're like, "Hi, Larry."
Gotcha.
So yeah, that's what
Larry's Fly Shop.
Larry's Fly and Supply. Yeah. I wanted it to be Larry's Bait and Tackle, but I figured people would actually come
looking for crawlers. Bait.
Yeah. So Larry's Fly and Supply. It's in Columbia Falls, Montana. And then...
that's cool.
Yeah. I run Trout TV out of
there too. That's a good name for a shop.
Thanks, man. Thought long and hard about it. Not really.
Yeah, it's like it's a refreshing name for a fly shop.
Well, it's the other part too is it's a dude's name, right? Larry.
No,
and
I get
so
it. I get it. That's
I
not
was
lost,
waiting for somebody to come in and ask for Larry, and it finally happened this summer. Finally, a guy came in. No, I mean I rung him. I didn't recognize him. Most of the time, anybody in my town, they get a discount and recognize them. It's like their shop too, kind of a thing. And but if they're a tourist and maybe they come in, they're kind of an asshole or something, I'm not going to give them a discount. So I come in, I ring this guy up and he leans forward and he's like, "Well, Larry always gives me a discount."
What?
Yeah. And I was like, "Does he?"
No,
Larry's not here today.
Yeah, Larry, it's Larry's day off. You got me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Anyways, Cal.
Ryan Callahan. Get a run around with Steve and Yanni on occasion, and I work with First Light. We make hunting clothes, great clothes. Check them out. And I have no kids.
You know how to say harpooner in Spanish?
Come on,
Fiscadoro.
Fiscadoro, yeah. I got that mixed up with your pinky
Tuscaderos.
Pinky Tuscaderos.
No kids. That you know.
Oh. Come on.
No, but Cal is family. You can't look him up. Oh, I'm not even you can talk about that if you want to talk about it.
I tried a dating website and
you hit a few dates.
I went on a couple of dates, first couple of dates in a long time, and I just kind of came to the conclusion that I got a lot of stuff going on and hunting season's around the corner, so I should probably just pump the brakes on that situation. So
you can take the profile down.
No, because it's pretty entertaining when you're sitting on the pot. So, Yanni.
That's sexy image. That'll help.
I can just see them all trying to figure out what app that is right now.
All right, Yanni. Yanni's
DiseaseCucumber.com.
I'll do Yanni's for him. Yanni's the guy that won't make me my damn flies.
That's how I was going to introduce myself. The guy that's too busy to make Steve's flies. I've been shooting my bow. I've been riding my bike. What other recreating have I been doing? No fishing.
Chasing the babies.
Chasing babies around.
Father too. You cool on that? Okay. Now, what I want to talk about, I want to talk about stream access. And I'm trying to find a way to even how to like address. Oh, I forgot about my. I did that segue earlier. So, now, I'm trying to think of a good way into this. That's going to help set the scene. All right. So, when you, if anyone's listening, ever walked down like the beach, okay, and you're walking down a beach. Let's say you're even on a lake or on the ocean, and you're walking down the beach, and you're walking where people have homes or condominiums or golf courses or whatever on the land, and you're allowed to walk down the beach. Okay, you're doing a type of legal access there, where the water is not privately owned. Okay, so land ownership on the ocean or in the U.S. typically. Land ownership on lakes, oceans, large rivers extends down to the water's edge, and there's varying definitions on what the water's edge is, and you can kind of cruise along there. The same way, if you go down to the Mississippi River and watch on the Mississippi River, you will see recreational vessels, commercial vessels vying their way up and down the river with no regards to who owns the land on the banks. Meaning, if I own both sides of the Mississippi River, I have no say over what goes on in that river. I can't yell at someone and say, hey, you can't conduct intracontinental commerce up and down this here river because I happen to own the land on each bank and I'm declaring the Mississippi River as my own. Now, that's the Mississippi. Extend that down, to go smaller and smaller, you have the Ohio River. The Ohio River, giant river, is a navigable river. If you own land on both sides of the river, you can't impede public access and commercial traffic up and down the river. As you shrink down, you get to sort to streams, rivulets, creeks, where at some point there arises a question of can the public use this waterway or not? Or with even it can happen, we're talking about stream access specifically here, but it can happen with lakes too. Is can the public have access to the littoral zone, the border between land or the seam where land meets water or the water itself? I grew up on a lake called Middle Lake in Twin Lake, Michigan. Now, Middle Lake, thankfully, I used to hate it, but now I'm mature enough to love it. Middle Lake had a public access boat launch. Okay, a fella could, when I was growing up, walk down the public access boat launch and then walk all the way around the lake. And he could fish and wade and even use the docks along the lake because those docks were built out over public water. Certain people would love to come out and yell at you and tell you and try to yell at you and say you weren't allowed there, but I knew enough to know that you were. And that was an access issue. So just because my family owned property on the lake didn't mean we could tell people they couldn't boat in front of our house or walk down the beach in front of our house. At my fish shack in Alaska, I cannot come out and start screaming and hollering at someone who goes and anchors their skiff in front of my shack on the cove I'm on because that's not my water. That's the people's water. Where this all becomes a debate where this becomes an issue that's being fought out in courts and around the country is particularly with streams that are kind of on the border of navigable or not. Even though I try to stay away from getting too Montana-centric with all kinds of Montana people here, let's talk for a minute about Montana, and I'll introduce and I'll kind of bring up a creek that I'm familiar with and sort of explain what I'm saying. One time, there's a creek in Montana called Lolo Creek, and it's named after a fella who I believe he was killed by a grizzly in there, a trapper named Lolo. He's buried somewhere around there, too. I think he got killed by a grizzly, and his buddy buried him up there.
Okay. I don't know that story.
People argue about where he was buried. I think someone thought they found where he was buried. But he grew by Lolo. He's a French dude. got a mountain, got a town named after him, got a creek named after him, got a national forest named after him, got a peak named after him. There's another
brewery. A brewery's named after him now.
A brewery's named after him. Another dude named Laramie. So a guy named Laramie comes out to Wyoming, a would-be mountain man, comes out to Wyoming, gets killed by Indians. They stuff him under they chip a hole in the ice of a beaver pond and stuff him down in there. Some bitch winds up with a town, river, mountain range.
All you gotta do is just die.
Yeah. Telling you. So, Lolo Creek. One time I hiked over the divide of the Bitterroots down into the headwaters of Lolo Creek with a pack raft. And in on national forest land, inflated my pack raft during spring runoff and started coming down the river. And I remember that I was in what was regarded initially as a non-navigable stretch of that river. So by floating down the river, I was actually trespassing on whoseever land that creek flowed through. Then I magically hit a point at a bridge where that river became legally navigable. I was then allowed, I then entered a part where I didn't have to be paranoid, and I was then allowed to float through all the ranch land as long as I stayed below what's called high water mark. At that point, it was regarded as legally navigable because in the historic record, there is information to suggest that from that point down, people used to float timber. They would stick logs in Lolo Creek at that point and float them down to the Bitterroot and use it for commerce. So the state recognizes that Lolo Creek from that point down is a navigable river, meaning once someone has legal access into the river, they can wade, fish, float, other F things. As long as you stay, other legal activities, as long as you stay below high watermark, meaning you stay below the bank of the river as described by the water's level at peak point. So if it's a drought, you can walk in the mud as long as it is where river normally occupies during high water.
Yes. And the way that gets defined too is a lot of like it's vegetation change, right? Like you have a definite vegetation change from like stuff that has water over the top of it so it doesn't grow very well to something that's really well established. So you can kind of tell that difference. That
yeah. And it also like cut banks and various things. I'm almost done talking, but I just want to lay a little more basic groundwork.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be good to touch on too on where the whole definition of navigable comes from.
Yeah, because there's commercial
different
use.
States divine it, different states
no,
divine.
But that's the thing. It's actually more of a federal thing, and it's kind of like an accepted federal definition of the waterways. It's actually the states that are more fighting over the land, which is kind of what we're talking here, because it's the access of the land. You know, if you're talking about walking down it and not just floating it, like the Army Corps of Engineers have always been the ones that have kind of like set the base level for navigable. And some states define that differently by saying as long as you're doing anything, it could be commercial, could be fishing, could be hunting, any sort of recreating. But, I mean, you said it. It's like Lolo Creek, they were pushing logs down it, you know. But some sort of use like that, you know, deems it navigable. But the Army Corps of Engineers have been the ones that have kind of like set the definition for that. And then the states take that and kind of interpret it.
Well, the states look at it too as, at the time of statehood, did we use it as a highway? Did we use it as the main mode of transportation to kind of build our cities and our towns and start to create that commerce? So if you're able to look at it and say that at our time of statehood, this is how we built our state, we used this waterway as the way to actually build our existence here, then that's the way that, you know, they're able to win lawsuits in Utah, for example.
Okay, I need to do something real quick. I need to point out, before people get too lost, I'm going to point out why this matters. Why this matters is, all these definitions we're talking about pertain to you if you like to hunt and fish and recreate and float. They pertain to you because there are people out there, wealthy, very well-connected people out there, who are trying to limit down, very aggressively, try to limit down where you can go on the water. There are a lot of people who own land, and they're like, why in the hell can Joe Schmo come floating down this river and cross in front of my land that is for me? I don't like seeing it. I wish they weren't able to come down and catch the fish that live in this river or whatever, because it pisses me off. I paid a lot of money, worked hard all my life, and now I got any old asshole can come floating down the river in front of my house. And it gets a little more complicated than that too. Like, for instance, you have people who want to sell the idea of exclusive access on rivers, and so they're trying to limit down stream access and access points. That's why this kind of matters. But let's go back real quick to the Montana issue. Montana recognizes by law, right? It's recognized in Montana, you have legal stream access.
Yes.
If you can legally get into a river, you're allowed to use it. But where is it becoming a thorny issue?
So I think it goes back to something you just said, is I think a lot of folks that are moving into Montana that, one, don't understand the culture, but then, two, were sold that piece of property. Like, you are buying a piece of Montana. And so they're like, well, I love that piece.
3 miles of exclusive access on...
Which is, they aren't told the laws that are in place right now that explain to that any, you know, asshole can go, like, you know, fish and float and wade in front of
them. Just regular old poor people floating by.
Me included. And so, like, when they buy that piece of property and then they see that person, they're like, whoa, wait a minute. And so I think they're being sold a bill of goods a little bit, that they're not getting told the whole truth when they buy that piece of property.
Like, some big figures in this debate, people who are trying to limit access on things that people have always accessed. Can we say the names?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, like Charles Schwab,
Jim Kennedy. I mean, those are the two biggest ones, probably.
And he's part of the Cox Communications.
Yep. He's got, you know,
Sailor Lane was the big.
Sailor Lane, yeah, over down in off the Ruby. And so I think these are billionaires that have lots of money. And mm-hmm. so, you know, like, what they tried to do in Montana was, first, they tried to change our stream access law. Now, the state legislature, you know, has all sorts of hearings that happen over in Helena. And, you know, I think medical marijuana was a big one, you know, not too long ago, and maybe 150 people will show up to that medical marijuana. You start talking about stream.
What are you saying? When they had a medical marijuana,
like, hearing, like, hearing. Everybody, like, you know, there's 150 people that show up. That's kind of a big deal. Now,
150 people who, like, want to smoke weed and let everybody know they want,
and like, want to express sides. Their want to express yeah. their.
No one shows up at something like that to say, I don't want people to smoke weed.
There's sure. plenty. There's
oh,
plenty.
Really?
Plenty. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a whole nother conversation.
Because people get way more excited about wanting to smoke weed than they do about not wanting people to smoke
there's
weed.
There's a culture in Montana that
there's
doesn't want
a lot of people that show up.
They would show up
say.
To be like, I don't want.
Yeah, it's the root of all evil.
I don't even smoke
Reefer
weed.
Reefer madness, dude. Yeah. All right. Yeah. But so, like, there's 150 people that show up to that, where you'd think there may even be more. But a stream access hearing comes up, and they can't even hold it where they want to hold it. They have to have it in the old Supreme Court chambers because 450 people show up. With pitchforks, and now that one is like 100-1, where you have 100 people saying, don't take our access away, and one person saying, please, you know, we want it for ourselves.
Oh, what's the pitchfork?
And the pitchfork is basically saying, hell no. I mean, like, there couldn't be anything more. Like,
saying, hell no, I'm going to pitchfork a floater, or I'm going to pitchfork a landowner?
He's using it as a symbol.
I'm like, you know, like, when like, the mob shows up.
Oh, so they didn't actually have a pitchfork.
No, sorry.
I thought it was a symbol.
Yeah, no.
Like, you can picture, like, at Trump rallies, if all of a sudden it became a thing to bring a pitchfork with you.
Right.
Like, everyone have a pitchfork. You know what I mean? It's like, you just picture it.
Leave your pitchfork at home. But, and so, like, 500 people show up, and so I think it shows you how much this matters to Montanans. And so we were able to stop them from changing any kind of laws. A while ago, they just, like, the last legislative session, they had a bill that was forward that said any place that had an irrigation structure on it was now going to become off limits to stream access. And so any kind of structure that comes off of a river or off of a stream that we have access to right now, if it was anything was being used for irrigation, then we wouldn't have been able to float it.
Back up from it. All right. Here's my nightmare right now. My nightmare right now is people aren't understanding what we're saying.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right.
There's really good examples.
That's what I want to talk about. Because I just want to clarify something first off. The laws have traditionally been interpreted a certain way.
For the people.
And there are people, we named a handful, like high-profile cases would be land owned by Charles Schwab, land owned by Cox, land owned by other individuals, who own land right now, and they're trying to make it, they're trying to say, let's step back, get our lawyers involved, and see if we can find a way to prohibit people from accessing a stream that they can now access. And one way they do that is trying to find legal ways to, like, legal wrangling methods.
So the first thing they tried to do is legislatively. Second thing they tried to do is just legal wrestling that you're talking
like
about.
Like changing definitions or challenging definitions.
Challenging definitions goes all the way to the Supreme Court. I think one of the arguments during when they were in front of the Montana Supreme Court was, as one of the questions was, do you want to change the Constitution of Montana? And they said yes. Like, that's what they're trying to do, is change the Constitution, which is you do by laws. And so there's the legal side. They've lost at the legislative level. They've lost at the legal
level. And what was the argument in the legislative level?
It's like a private property takings that should have never been in the place. It was a takings back in 85 when it first got established.
Gotcha. So they were saying, you're taking my private property by letting Joe Schmo float down a river.
Exactly.
But if you look at the U.S. Constitution, the U.S. Constitution has waterways as a means of travel. And it says every U.S. citizen has a right to these thoroughfares, basically. Yeah. They're a road as much as a road.
Yeah, again, no one's arguing that if I go and buy some land in Missouri and Illinois, that I can shut down commerce on the Mississippi River. Right?
Correct.
You wouldn't get far. But it's these, you know, as you get smaller and smaller and smaller, people start to be like, come on now, this is ridiculous. I could throw a rock across this river. You shouldn't be able to come through it.
And to go back to you and Jimmy and I sitting in the canoe, that, I mean, you could, Jimmy, 6 years old, get underhand a rock from bank to bank. We had an incredible time on that river, and there's a lot of people out there saying that would say it.
You should have checked with the landowner.
Right.
Yeah. All right.
So go back, though. So they've tried it legislatively. They've tried to legally.
Legally was changing the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they'd have to do.
They're just saying, like, to hell with it. If that's the case, let's just rewrite the whole thing.
Yep, and so they've lost both those, and so now they're trying to change the Supreme Court in Montana. So if you can't win at a legislative level, which is basically the people, right? You can't do it at the court level. Now they're trying to do it at the Supreme, like at the highest level, so that they can get different judges in there that will interpret the law in a different way, and so that the stuff that we have now doesn't give us the protections that we have on stream access. So, you know, and when you think about the billions of dollars they have, and these guys, they're not used to losing, right? And so they're not going away. And so, like, right now in Montana, there's a Supreme Court race that is vitally important to this whole issue.
Meaning what?
Well, I think it was 5-2 last time that this was decided at Montana Supreme Court. So this would make it 4-3 if this person got in, and that takes one more, and then all of a sudden we're tied.
And there are people who'd be sympathetic to the landowner side.
Yes.
Hillary, here's a challenge.
And lots of money are at stake, too.
Here's a challenge for you. Act like you're a landowner, a wealthy landowner. Give me his argument.
I agree with the real estate part of it. When you want that chunk of Americana, for the right reasons, okay? Let's just say, you know, you want to get your family out there. It's beautiful. You've worked really hard all your life. You know, this. You've saved up, and you really want that kind of chunk to pass on to future generations, right? So those are reasons to want to be a landowner in Montana. And you're an honest, hardworking kind of person.
And you're going
to
be a steward of the land.
And you're going to be a steward of the land, and you're going to take care of it, and you're not going to even, like, develop it and rape and pillage, right? This is your plan. So you go look, and you find the perfect spot, and God, there's a river runs through it. You know, awesome. This is the spot. Marge, we're going to move out here. We're going to bring all the grandkids. They're going to come for Christmas. This is going to be amazing. And then you buy it, you get sold this piece of Americana, this whole view that you've wanted, you've worked hard all your life, and you get out there, and shit, there's Hillary standing out in the middle of it, looking like a fish hippie down there.
Hillary, but her two screaming teenagers.
Exactly, and all of their homies. Yeah, so, you know, and you're like, this isn't what I signed up for. This isn't what I want. And
there's people walking through my property.
Yeah, and you're thinking that the river's a property. And then the other thing that you start to worry about is, oh my gosh, what if somebody gets hurt? I'm going to get sued. What if somebody gets hurt down there? What if somebody drowns down there? What if, what if I want to fish there later tonight and they've completely, you know, sore mouthed all my fish? What if they make a mess? What if they take a dump behind that tree? What if they, all of these things? And you're like, this isn't fair. That's my backyard, right? My personal opinion about some of the...
Oh, you're still role playing?
No, now I'm out of it.
I didn't know if the role play
person was
like, man, this is a very good role play.
Now tell me
what's wrong with that vision.
Now,
or your personal opinion about that vision.
Right. So
interpret
that's
the vision.
Small scale, you know, person who just kind of wants their own chunk for themselves. But the bigger problem also is those small pieces and those people add up to bigger picture of, like, larger landowner opportunities. And I'm not saying that just the smaller owner is okay. I'm fighting for stream access, you know, for the public. But all of those small arguments for those small 5-acre plots that have little bits of river running through kind of all are voices that can add together and can actually hurt everybody's access and everybody's use. So my argument is not just about access, because pretty much everywhere you go, you have access, meaning you can access the river. It's also use. So it's the way we use the river. Once you access it in a public place, then you can walk all the way up and down it below high water mark, and then it's our use. We need to be able to fish it. We need to be able to float through. We need to be able to anchor up. We need to be able to have an amazing shore lunch.
And some people define it as all legal activities.
And all of the activities that I experience and that I do on public lands, you know, we see as for the entire population, for everybody to be able to do. Now, what happens when we all do that together? It has to be out of respect, right? So you have to respect the land. You have to respect the private landowners. So if you've got private landowners on either side, maybe it's the same one who owns both sides, like you were describing before, and this water runs through and we have public access at a certain point, but we've walked down or floated down, fished down, and we're going through their private property. The water is ours as the public to use. The fish are all of ours to share and enjoy. The rocks that are tumbling and moving all the time are all of ours. There's stream beds. And,
yeah, and I want to interrupt you real quick just to point out a thing. The water is owned by the state. The state doesn't relinquish the water
right. As
it flows through your property.
Right.
The fish are owned by the state, and the state generally will not relinquish the rights of the fish that are living in the water that they own
right. That's
flowing across your property.
Exactly. So now, if you're the private landowner and you recognize all of these things, then we have a great partnership, right? Because you've still got your land, and then we as fishermen and recreators are going to respect it. That means, no, you guys, don't run your dogs up in there. Don't let your dogs go running up above high water mark. Don't make a big camp, you know, that's going to potentially have wildfires that could go up into their property unless you're really certain that you're in an actual legal spot, you know? Be really respectful of those private landowners as we use what is our right. You know, it is our right to use this waterway and have a blast. But God, you know, I mean, we have to really respect ourselves by respecting those private landowners.
Comes with a bit of responsibility.
Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate because I hate to see people mess it up. And it's one of the things I see happen is as we're floating along, you know, and if I'm guiding and I've been guiding the same stretch of river for a long time, you know, up in the Middle Fork in Nyack, as you know, Cal, if you haven't been there in a little while and you float now, you see these big private property signs that there never were before, because there are sections of private property along there. And it's always been private in a couple of these stretches, you know, but we've always had the ability to float through. We still can. But when you see those private property signs, it's like, oh, shoot, somebody must have messed up. One of us must have gone up there and picked huckleberries on their property. One of us must have, like, run our dogs up there. Something happened to piss those guys off. Or maybe it's just fear. Maybe they're new landowners there, and maybe they're afraid that we're going to. So it's important for two reasons. We now can make it right by making sure that we do the right thing now, and then also be telling people that this is a partnership. This, you know, you've got your land you worked hard for. You know, you own it. We all together own this water and this fish and the rocks, and we can work together on it. I sound like a diplomat, but I'm not.
I appreciate what you're saying. I think it's an important thing to point out. When I used to butt up most sort of my crash course in stream access and my crash course in landowner relationships came when we used to do a lot of floating for ducks and geese. Okay. And I remember early on when we got interested in floating rivers for ducks and geese, like rivers that flowed through ranch land, I called, trust me, we're going to get away from Montana real quick here, but this happened in Montana. I called Fish and Game, and I was saying, okay, so fella can float the Bitterroot, I understand. We're going to float down and jump shoot, pass shoot for ducks and geese. What are kind of things are we up against? You know, like for instance, in where I grew up in Michigan, I can't remember what it is, but you can't fire a gun within 450 or some odd feet of a structure on someone's land. So even if you're on your own land, if your neighbor's place is within that distance of your border, you got to get written permission from that neighbor before you fire off a firearm, no matter what direction you're aiming it in. I was just curious, is there anything like that going on? I was told there that the only problem I could foresee is that you'd hit someone's house. If you hit someone's house with your shotgun, that's negligence. And that is
that's
a problem for you. But no, go for it. So we started doing a lot of floating for ducks and geese. And one day we're putting in at illegal access on the East Gallatin, fixing the float through there. And a guy comes racing up to tell us that we had gotten ourselves, he was the landowner, and to explain that we were in a catch 22. He was saying, I'm watching you. When you hit a duck down and it lands on my land, if you go to get that duck, I'm going to get you for trespassing. If you don't go and get that duck, I'm going to call in for wanton waste. So watch it. And we always were real careful about not tipping ducks over on the guy's property. But that was the first time I ever started really getting into that use thing. And again, for him, I imagine he's motivated by a handful of things. Maybe the guy likes to hunt ducks. And just on a purely selfish level, he's just kind of pissed off that he can't have this private supply of ducks. Maybe on another level, he's pissed off for watching guys send ducks sailing off into his alfalfa field, and they don't go pick it up because they're afraid to go trespass. And he sees some real wasteful activity and might wonder, why in the hell would you float such a small river that you can't go retrieve birds off of without trespassing on my land? And then leave like crippled ducks laying around. It's outrageous. Just because someone is I'm just pointing out, like you did, just because someone is opposed to stream access might be based off of various things. I don't want to sell it as this like rich versus poor kind of thing, which is tempting to do when so many of the most vocal critics of stream access happen to be billionaires who are coming from out other cultures into a place and being a little bit baffled by what goes on.
A lot of the homeowners don't know. I mean, that's the bottom line, is a lot of them don't know that it's not theirs. They bought this and they don't know. And I've spent a lot of time in Utah with my friends I fish with there, kind of going door to door, even though we know we're going in a legal spot. And that spot's, you know, the Provo and the Weber have just been pushed down because so much public use has been locked down. And so now when there is a public spot, and you go in there, you talk to the homeowners around it just to chit-chat with them and see if they know what's up. They know the laws, and every time it's appealed, then everybody gets confused. And, you know, and a new one-mile piece of water opens, and then that gets appealed, and it's shut down and open. There's a lot of confusion that goes on around it, like you were just saying with the show. You know, people are like, what's going on? Which is kind of why Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is really focused right now on putting together one place where everybody can go to learn about what laws are applicable where you live.
Yeah, which is a great resource. And
segue, eh?
It is a good segue, because what's that river in Virginia?
Jackson.
Okay, this is an interesting river. Now, I'm gonna lay some groundwork. You tell me when I mess up, and I'll tell you when I run out of stuff I know about. Jackson River in Virginia was a warm water river, warm water stream. They put in a big tailwater dam. Correct?
Put in a dam that created a tailwater.
Put in a dam that created a tailwater. What a tailwater is where you build a dam and you build a big impoundment of water. Now, when you impound water or have a lake, the water at the surface tends to be much warmer than the water down below, as is known to anyone who's ever been swimming and dived down to the bottom, and it gets real cold all of a sudden. A tailwater, instead of releasing water from the surface, which is like what a beaver pond does, right, where the water flows off the top of the beaver dam, a tailwater releases water from the bottom of the water column, and it sends out cold water. What a tailwater does by sending out all that cold water is you create a cold water fishery, and it allows you to have cold water species to flourish. Trout like cold well oxygenated water. Tailwaters generally are great for trout because you're sending continuous cold water year-round. It's not sun-baked and all heated up. And you can have places like the White River in Arkansas, the Jackson River in Virginia, that will support great trout fisheries because the fish are always getting nice cold water, no matter how hot the weather is. This river had never had a stream access debate. It was just a river people could use. The tailwater came in and also became a destination trout fishery. Landowners along the river were like, man, it would be sweet if only I could fish these trout. bummer that all these other mofos can come down here floating and fishing. They got to digging around and realized that when King George the First and King George the Second did some land grants back in the old-timey times, in the 1700s, they'd be like, man, you're a great guy. You've always done great service for us. Here's a gigantic hunk of land. This is pre-U.S. All right, this is when we were a colony. They would that when he granted, when King George granted chunks of land, this sort of initiated the idea of private property ownership in the U.S., he pointed out that you own the whole damn river and everything that's in it. So based on that, now that there's something in there that I really want, based on that, we're going to get together and make a play to say no one can access the Jackson River of Virginia except private landowners along the banks. It's so complicated, if I understand this correct, that the Fish and Game in Virginia, rather than trying to clarify the issue, it's so complicated that they just alert anglers and floaters to the fact that you may encounter landowners who are making certain claims. We don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
Break that all down.
Well, and I think it's gone. Like, there's been a lawsuit over it. There was actually a kayaker who got like busted by one of these landowners, and they said he was trespassing. So there was a lawsuit over that to try to fine him for trespassing. And this has only gone, from what I know, it's only gone to one level of judge, and that judge sided with the landowner. And so right now, like, that area is closed down to fishing, to floating, to anything. And so, to me, though, Steve, that's what we were trying to get away from when we created America, right? And, like, when you think about, like we established this country to where the water belonged to the people and the wildlife belonged to the people. You've already, you know, we've talked about that earlier. And, you know, the state kind of is our manager of that. And to me, that flies in the face of that. And so I think if somebody challenges that up to a higher court, I think we will win that one. Because when I start hearing King's grants from the 1700s, I'm like, that's what we revolted against, yeah. You know, like, that stuff doesn't matter anymore. Cause if it did, then like the East Coast would look a lot different than it does right now.
Yeah. KG doesn't get to do that
in
America.
No. So to me, I think that one will be challenged and we'll win. But right now it's definitely a confusing piece.
Yeah. As far as the way, you know, the European system and the American system. So the European system, goes back to, like, think of Robin Hood, right? Robin Hood was a poacher. Because the king owned the wildlife, and Robin Hood would go out and hunt. And you could get in a lot of trouble for hunting in England and other places because wildlife only belonged to wealthy landowners. The U.S. is a direct repudiation of that system, where we have an excellent, arguably, and I'm not just saying this because I'm American, we have the best wildlife management system in the world, which has been proven again and again to work very well. And we have what's called public ownership of wildlife. Wildlife is held in a public domain, meaning that if a trout is swimming in a river, it doesn't matter whose land he crosses. He remains the property of the people of that state, the public. If an elk is in Yellowstone National Park and he jumps a fence and goes onto National Forest land, and he jumps another fence and goes onto BLM land, and he jumps another fence and goes onto a private ranch and jumps another fence and becomes into a municipal park, throughout all of his wanderings, he has remained a possession of the people. Now, you might be able to control access to that elk, but you never take ownership of that elk. So one thing that's at stake when we're talking about access to waterways is it's a tool by which people can come in and try to subvert our system and try to take ownership of wildlife resources that belong to the American people. It's just one of many tools in a tool bag that you can use to claim something that traditionally is not yours to claim. Now, tell me about another river.
I mean, I think
there's a good story from a Missouri river, right? Not the Missouri River, but a river in Missouri.
Well, I mean, I think the story in Missouri is about all their rivers. I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people think that this is just a Western issue.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get away from, because growing up in Michigan, I remember one time when I used to run mink traps, I was at Cedar Creek where M120 crosses Cedar Creek, and Cedar Creek's a navigable river. And I remember having a DNR officer, basically a fish and game officer, come and tell me that I had to pull my mink traps on the upstream side of the bridge, because downstream side was Manistee National Forest. Upstream was private ownership. I would jump into the creek on the Manistee National Forest side, go underneath the bridge in waders, and then set mink traps in the water on the upstream side, which I knew to be legal. He was confused about the issue and told me that I wasn't actually allowed to do that. I had to stay on the downstream side, even though it's a legally navigable river. So, what was my point there?
Well, I think what you're trying to say
is that it's not a Western issue.
It's not a Western issue.
So here I am, a dude trapping mink in Michigan, having the same conversation, but for some reason it's become like, I don't know why it's become a West, why it's perceived as the Western issue. When we got like Virginia, and we got what you're going to talk about.
Yeah,
Missouri.
So in Missouri, I mean, they've tried to do the same thing they've tried to do in Montana, is change the laws. And so in Missouri, you do have the right to wade up to the high water mark in Missouri. And so there's been two attempts now at their legislature to repeal that and change the law. And so the people, once again, in Missouri, the show me state, stood up and said, no, not here. And so that said, these folks aren't going away, you know? I mean, that want to kind of take this stuff for themselves. And so I think that's one of the things, is like this vigilance. Like, I mean, and we've talked about this before on the whole public lands divestiture issue, is that we're a very young country, and there's been folks trying to take things for themselves ever since Roosevelt kind of, you know, started this whole, you know, idea of the land belongs to the people. And there was stuff that happened before that too. But the reason that we still have public lands and public hands, and the reason we still have stream access, is because countless people have stepped up and said, that's not what America is. America was established in a different place, or in a different way, just how you described it, how it's different from the European model, right? And so these things will continue to happen, but in Missouri, yeah, I mean, there's definitely an attack on stream access, and they were able to push it down, but that doesn't mean it's not going to come back again.
Callahan, what do you think about all this?
I got a case in New York State.
Oh,
okay. This information comes from by a beautiful young, smart attorney in Helena, Montana.
They used to date.
Yes.
What happened there? Like, why'd that relationship not work?
Oh, like I said, we just grew apart. Right? You know, part of it is she had this bird dog that she didn't train to hunt birds, and I couldn't wrap my head around that.
And that caused a rift in your relationship.
Yeah, things kind of separated from there.
And you called her up and or sent her some sort of message.
Yeah. Yep. So she did some bird dogging.
She married now?
No. No, she is not.
When you guys text, is there any innuendo?
Always, but that's just kind of her sense of humor.
Huh. Yeah. Well, there's no chance it's going to get going again.
I don't think so. I think I've burned that bridge
not
down
now.
About half a
whatever
dozen
she
times.
Is helping right now. Let's think about that.
Yeah, but what she wants.
So, okay, so
she wants
halibut. She's an environmental lawyer.
Yeah.
She wants halibut.
Yeah.
Okay.
Typical.
And what's the New York State deal?
Okay, so 2013 access was challenged in New York. And a man's canoeing down a navigable waterway. He has to portage his canoe. That portage takes him across land that is posted for no trespassing. Landowner.
Because of a beaver dam or whatever.
Yeah, log in the river, some sort of obstruction. And so the landowner sues, or, you know, tries to ding this guy for no trespassing. He brings up the navigable waterway in the U.S. Constitution, says that you can use land even above the high water mark to get around obstructions.
Gotcha.
To navigate this thoroughfare, essentially. And 2016, New York Supreme Court declines to rule. So what happens is, since they declined to rule, the predetermined laws stand, which means you can trespass on somebody's land to continue your travel.
If a log or a beaver dam or whatever.
Right.
You can't hang out there. You just have to keep going.
Correct.
Yeah, I read this morning that portaging, because it falls under something you would do while boating, hunting, fishing, whatever, that would then be encompassed in using that waterway, and so it would fall under legal use and not be trespassed.
The right to navigate includes the necessary incidental use of bed and banks.
Oh. Now, Giannis, explain, like, when you work, because every state's different, explain the situation in Colorado. Is that where there's weird shit, like you can float down the river, but you can't set an anchor?
Yeah.
Explain that.
That is weird.
Well, and I think that's where it does get really tricky, and which I was talking about earlier is because, like, they have the navigable waterway thing figured out, where they, like, they can't put a fence across it and keep you from going down it. But Colorado, the state, has chosen to say that the land underneath is owned by somebody and not by the people. And so if you own
just the water's owned by the people, not the not the vessel holding the water.
Exactly.
Even though all these rocks are tumbling down.
Yeah, I never thought about that, but you made a good point. It's like that riverbed is just constantly changing. Yeah. Like your rock is on the neighbor's rock or the neighbor's property, you know, every
year. Yeah, I'd be out there being like, give me my rock back, you son of a bitch.
Right?
Yeah. That thing rolled down to your land.
Yeah. So no, man, I don't know if you guys had to do that guiding here in Montana, but in Colorado, I mean, there's this trick you do with your raft is you'd pull in behind. You would know every single rock that had just enough, like, reverse current where you could pull in and you'd have to re-rig everybody's
flies. You get way too far ahead.
Sorry.
Explain the problem.
Oh, yeah. So you're floating down these rivers that you want to fish.
And it's private land on both sides.
Both sides.
And the bay.
Give me some names of rivers.
The Eagle River, the Colorado River, the Running Fork. It doesn't matter. Any one you're floating in that state.
Big famous rivers.
Yeah, if you're going through private property, you cannot anchor. You can't pull over.
Can't wade.
Can't wade. Can't get out of the boat. You can't even stick your boat onto a rock to stop.
You can't push pole.
Can't push pole. You can't grab willow branches to hold yourself in place. Nothing. Just you and the water. That's it. That's the only
So context. You can't beach up on a rock that's out in the river.
No. It's trespass.
Because you're using that dude's rock.
Yeah, so what we would learn how to do is you'd find just the right rock that had just enough eddy for like a 12.5-foot super puma, and you'd pull in there, and you'd have the guy actually in the back looking down and be like, let me know if I'm bumping that thing. And you'd sit there and like just do these little feather strokes and drop your oars underneath your knees, tie, put them back, couple little feather strokes, tie.
Why can't
you
tie his
own
thing?
Look up on the bank and there'd be the dude on the ATV just sitting there watching, just waiting. And he knew who I was, you know, I mean, he'd have a cell phone and be calling the shop, you know, Yanni's on that rock again, just passing.
Do you pee off the boat? They have to pee off the boat?
Yep.
Oh, they can't climb up on the bank to pee. You know, when we were fishing this week, our boat was so filthy, I had my boy peeing right into the boat. I was like, it ain't going to hurt anything now, man. This boat's so full of slime. And
drink blood. Some more water. We need to clean this thing up.
First, I had him peeing over the edge, but it was so wavy, I'm afraid it's going to fall over. Then I had him peeing in the bucket. Then toward the end, I'm like, just go ahead.
There's a lot of very defined systems up there for the fish shack, as you well know. And whenever one of those systems like falls apart, it's so apparent as to why you bring X amount of buckets, a cooler,
yeah,
scrub brushes, stuff like that.
I know one time he was whizzing in the boat and Callahan picked up all the basket full of a perforated basket full of shrimp tails and moved it up to a seat.
Which one was? we had about 3 inches of muddy guts, blood, water in the bottom of the boat, and Jimmy's like, hold on, I gotta pee. Steve and I are cleaning shrimp right there, and it's a laundry basket full of the shrimp tails.
No, it's not a laundry basket.
A perforated basket.
It looks like a but it's not. They sell them. It's a fishing basket.
Really?
Me and Yanni found that one beachcombing.
Oh, nice.
But, yeah, it looks just like a laundry basket.
Yeah. Heavy duty. You have never found it.
For the folks at home that do not know.
Laundry basket.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yeah.
It's anyhow, like 6 times more expensive.
He whizzes into this 6 inches of filth. And then Callahan then picks up the shrimp tails like, oh, that's what's going to gross you out? It's not that it's full of rotten.
You make concessions.
Okay, so why was I talking about? Oh, so
Colorado,
you can't get on the bank and take
a whiz. Couldn't get on the bank. But I was going to say, it was always just like a minor issue on most rivers. But as soon as like the Blue River below Green Mountain Reservoir, giant private ranch down below there gets a bunch of giant fish stocked into it. that are fed and like words getting out.
How are they stocking and feeding fish they in do. A river?
The Gunnison's like that too, the upper Gunnison.
Well, so how do they know the fish aren't going to get away? They like don't. In Texas, they got that shit down. They put
I don't
a fence.
Think they care. I think they're they like, this is my private.
They restock it.
They can, you can feed fish in a river?
Mm-hmm.
Is that against the law?
I don't know about all places. I don't know if you can do that in Montana or even here in Washington.
I've never heard of that.
No, the bucket brigade kind of thing in Glacier National Park is largely frowned upon.
Yeah.
Do not plant fish in my zone.
Yeah. I imagine not.
It's a bummer on the, you know, on the first time ever fishing the Gunnison, I expected to be a madhouse. I was down there visiting some shops for work, swung in to fish with the old yellow dog. And
who's that?
No, literally my
dog. Oh, your
dog. Yeah.
Oh, okay. That was a guy. I saw this guy I never heard of before.
No, no, no. And I'm fishing away and everything's great. And then I catch this fish that is so obviously a like a pen raised, you know, super round nosed, nubby little fin.
Yeah, just that
fish.
Stalker look.
Pellet head.
Yeah, pellet fed. You know, I'm just like, what is, you know, kind of killed the
I
experience.
I had no idea. So, anyways, that stuff gets complicated.
This guy. Or his manager on this ranch, sometime when they were trying to like push back a little bit, they would know, like, because you can only float it at certain levels, you know, before you just, cause there was wing dams, all these river improvements to make pools. And so when it got too low, it was just too dangerous to drive the boats over these dams. But so they would know, like, okay, the river's coming up, they're going to release water, there's going to be a bunch of fish, a bunch of guys coming down to fish it. They would just power feed these fish for days ahead of time so that when you float it through there, I mean, you can see them all sitting on
but
the
they
bottom.
But they don't
want to
eat.
Giant,
they don't want to eat because they're all filled up.
Totally, full bellies.
You're kidding me. The story I like is this dude, this was in the Backcountry Hunters and Anglers magazine. This dude was selling, what state was this in? He was selling exclusive access on a stream. So there's like a developer who's selling exclusive access on a stream.
So that was Virginia. Or that's Virginia.
No,
too.
It's not. No, it's not.
Well, I know that was happening in Virginia too, but maybe it was Utah. I should know that.
I felt like that was on, wasn't it the Provo or a tributary to the Provo?
You mean
where there
kind
was like
of
that big development?
Yeah,
Utah.
Totally. Yeah, for sure.
Or now they're suing because it.
He's got a developer gets a chunk of property and he tells people you're buying exclusive access. Turns out it's not. It's public access. So the people get pissed at the guy they bought the land from. The guy that bought the land from turns around and sues some other dude for having messed this whole thing up.
I mean, that's the whole thing at Victory Ranch up in Utah. I mean, it's a development, right? So
this is the place.
Yeah.
Tell this story.
Well, I think one of the main things is if it's a development, you aren't doing your own research necessarily on that area. It's almost like in a lot of these kind of large subdivisions, you have these amenities that are just described to you, right? And that kind of to you is one of the amenities. If you're doing your own research, you look into what river you're buying your property on.
Yeah.
But if it's a big subdivision, you just know it's kind of one of the things. Like, for example, we also, there's this like big orchard over here and like we're going to put like this big group swimming pool in the middle and oh, there's a river here. Da-da. There's all these amenities, right? And so I think a lot of these people were kind of told that this is just one of those basic amenities that you get as part of it, and that was sold to them as exclusive access and use. But then when it turned out not to be, then they're like, well, let's make it so.
I got you.
You know. And they're like, we can't give you your money back.
He's like, wait, let me call my lawyer.
And so they start to find out it's not. And it wasn't like just going quietly into the night. It was like, okay, well, we're going to fight to make it as we said. Otherwise, how much value is that reducing? And whatever it was that they purchased, how much of that was because of the river, right? So they can't like give them their money back. They already bought. They already have their landscaping out. They already whatever. And so now instead of just saying, actually, we messed up, they're going, let's change the law and let's make it yours.
Yeah. What percent now as a fishing guide, what percent of the of time do you spend in your terrain where you guide? What percent of time do you spend fishing water that is flowing through private land?
Well, 100% of the water on which I guide is public access, public use. So it's the Middle Fork and the North Fork of the Flathead. But River Left on the Middle Fork, for example, has a significant amount of privately owned property.
Can you explain River Left?
So River Left is, as the river is flowing, everything on your left. So even if you flip your boat around, yeah. So if you're looking upstream, River Left is going to be on the other side. So River Left is always left side as the river flows. River Right is always right side as the river flows. So on the Middle Fork of the Flathead, River Right, 10 feet above high water mark, technically is Glacier National Park. So that's all national park. So you know that that's all public land. You just know that's what the boundary is as a professional guide, and hopefully as a private floater as well. It's not a permitted river, so anybody can float it. And then River Left is going to be state, federal, and private land. So it's split up just in different zones based on kind of, you know, state ownership and its Forest Service, and it's also privately owned.
And it's important to know in Montana, the land owner does not have the responsibility to post that land. It's the user, the person, that has the responsibility to know where those boundaries are and where you are as a human being.
That's
on the
good
face
shit.
Of the planet.
That's good shit to get into right there. I want to talk about that.
And
that's complicated.
That's huge. That's what I was saying before. It's our responsibility as the user to be well educated. Otherwise, we're going to get those big bright orange reminders on the trees. And I hate floating down the river guiding my people, and that's what they see. You know, private property, keep out, da da da. Because if those are gone, it looks like this, you know, beautiful place that we all know and love, and you take your photo and, you know, carry on, and it's great.
And you point out, and you believe that a lot of those signs are there because of us public users not respecting.
Yeah, I think it's
not respecting
either,
law and not respecting
I haven't
people.
Seen it. I haven't seen like disrespect really on the river where I work. I think locals are great. I think the visitors are great. I think the visitors do a lot of homework. The biggest way they could do that is by going with guides. Mm-hmm. You know, by having somebody show you how to do it, and maybe next time that they'll come back, they can do it themselves. But I think a lot of it is somebody either did something wrong, or there's the fear that something bad will happen there. The private landowner is afraid that somebody's going to come up on their property and something bad's going to happen, or maybe
and they're going to sue them, which isn't unreasonable.
Yeah, either they're going to somebody's going to get hurt and they're sue them, or else maybe they'll break into their house. I mean, people love to have that back deck open, you know, facing the river all the time. Somebody going to come in and steal my shit? You know, can I let my kids play out there? And there's all these people coming by. Is that even safe? You know, I mean, it's that typical fear in America that we have. And it's hard for me just because I've grown up there and I've worked there for so long to see that change happen. And it's like, oh man, no, it's just me. Hey, you know, it's cool. I'm not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's just kind of one of those growing things we see in America is a fear and a love for that to stop. And we have to be the ones to stop it just by being really respectful of those private landowners for sure. So to answer your question about like who's, when I guide, is it private property? Is it state or federal? It's really cool that it's a mix. Like Cal said, it's up to us to know the rules. And where I work, it's really cool that it's a mix. Now, on the North Fork of the Flathead, the boundary goes right smack dab down the river, in the middle of the river. Deepest part of the deepest channel. Exactly. So if you're floating the river, River Right is going to be that mix of state, federal, and private land. River Left is going to be all park side, Glacier National Park. So the Middle Fork and the North Fork form the two boundaries. The boundary's right smack dab down the middle. So that's why we tell everybody to get a
but
fishing
the rivers,
license.
The river's administered the same way, or you actually can't fish one side of the river without a certain license?
No, you can fish both sides. It's hysterical because that's why in Glacier National Park, you don't have to have a fishing license. Actually, you can fish in the park without a license, and it's free. But we make everybody get it because same thing like you were talking about the ducks. You catch a fish, and then on park side where it's free or whatever, and it swims over to the other side, and like you land it on the other side, you know. Up for debate a little bit. So everybody has to get a fishing license, and we try not to park. You don't really camp River Left on park side because you don't have a backcountry permit. You always camp River Right where it's Forest Service because you know that's a Forest Service camp. Even if it's not an established camp, you can camp there without it being an actual campground, but it's got to be on the public land. Yeah, within the high water mark.
I used to fish smallmouth and a lot of other things on the Delaware River, which is a wild and scenic, you know, a designated wild and scenic river, flows between, in the stretch I used to fish, flows between New York and Pennsylvania. Wild fish and smallmouth, we caught over the years, 9 different species of fish out of that river. But anyways, those two states came up with a collaborative agreement, which is pretty nice. I wish it happened more, where you could hold a license from either side and fish both sides. And they came together and made a regulation with bag limits and methods and seasons that made it so that river was jointly managed in a way that made sense to people. When I used to live in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, you have a gigantic river, the St. Mary's River, which one side's the U.S., one side's Canada. And there was a line running down there that was not easily discernible. And the seasons and structures were very different on each side of that line. It would create a lot of confusion for people out in boats. There's a story a buddy of mine, a guy who works at Benchmade, was telling me about a bass fisherman who's in a tournament and in the Mississippi River. And it's very confused, like what state's waters you're in. He's where several different states come together. And one of the states, you can't high-grade fish, meaning if you catch a fish and put it in your live well, and you got a limit, and you catch a bigger one, you turn one of those fish out and put the bigger one in. So unknowingly, he crossed the line and high-graded a fish in another state and broke a state law and wound up losing some absurd amount of money because it was a fishing tournament over that little differentiation there. And it does get a little bit complicated. I was always glad, like, I thought it was cool that Delaware did that, but that's usually not the case. You can get in some really confused shit when one side of a bank is owned, you know, is managed in some way and the other side is managed in a different way.
To the Colorado point, I was just trying to think about what it would be like to not be able to touch the rocks in the beds and stuff like that where I guide, because I'm out of the boat all the time, not just, you know, to fish it right. You know, sometimes we walk the boat. Sometimes, you know, it gets so skinny, I don't want to use my oars. I don't want to bang rocks or whatever. And so, you know, I'll move the boat myself. But also because being stewards of that river means we have an awful lot of things we have to do to help. We pick up a ton of trash, for example, you know, get people out of a jam. Like, I'm pushing boats off. You remember Callahan, like all these people coming down, they get stuck on rocks themselves. You're pushing them off rocks all the time and helping people out, giving people directions. You know, what happens if you see trash? You're not allowed to go pick it up because you're afraid of getting in trouble. You know, I mean, it just seems weird to not be able to be an actual steward of the entire piece, that everybody's got this own little bubble that they go into. Yeah, it's not the right way.
Where I'm at it with some of the other things. I totally understand the other side of the issue. I understand it because, like I said, I grew up on a lake that had public access. I own a place now that has it's on public access waterway. I understand both sides of the issue because I understand the feeling of, man, does it suck that on the lake where I grew up, when the bluegills come up on the beds in early June, they get hammered by dudes who walk down that access. I understand that you'd be like, man, I should call up and do a little sniffing around and find a way to make it that they can't come and do that. Because people are just like that. I think that we're like that overfishing game, where I imagine that the earliest wars we fought as our species, definitely the earliest wars we fought in this country, were wars that we fought over access to fish and game. Who's hunting grounds or who? When Lewis and Clark were traveling across the West, a lot of the places where they recorded the greatest concentrations of game turned out to be contested hunting grounds between different tribes. The no man's land's borders between different tribes, where it was not safe to go hunt and fish because of the chances you'd run into your competitors. And those areas tended to concentrate game. So we've always kind of like fought over access points and fought over rivers and fought over control of the Ohio and control of the Cumberland Gap, on and on and on, because we wanted those little things for ourselves. I get it. But the same way I do when it comes to issues of clean air and clean water, what I do when it comes to issues of public access, I am generally going to just instinctively side on the side of access, public access. It's like, it doesn't mean I don't understand the other arguments. If I could go in and argue them all day long, And I could probably be fairly convincing at it. Like, I have that much of a grasp on them. But if we don't watch out and protect public access, I feel as though we are going to slowly just get beat.
Well, here's my Pollyanna pipe up. Here's what I don't get about that private ownership. It's I love the hell out of sharing it. I mean, your bluegill thing, too. I guarantee.
Yeah, that's where you and me are different.
Well, I don't know. Like, there's something about going out there and, like, helping people get into them. I mean, really. And I bet you have that, too. I don't. Maybe not. Maybe
you're like that now with your fish shack.
You know?
Come on.
I like to share the fish shack. However.
How much time did you spend trying to get me a yellow eye?
Yeah.
I was the only person fishing in the boat.
I think it was the writer, John Geerick, who pointed out. Great fishing writer. Pointed out there's two kinds of fishermen. There's the guys in your party, and then there's the assholes. So, yeah, I love to take people out. But at the same time, now, there is a native tribal corporation that owns a lot of land near my fish shack. When they go in and cut timber, they clear cut it. They annihilate the place. And the one I'm talking about, Sea Alaska, they're going in to do a big cut right now.
Just what we saw.
And they are going to annihilate all the old growth on the two big inlets by my place. It's their land, right? It's their property. It makes me feel sick.
The destruction that we saw in 3 days without them taking a stick of lumber out, not one stick of lumber out, just getting things prepped to start taking lumber out, dynamite.
Dude,
dozers,
it's old growth timber. They will go after every scrap of old growth they can get. So it's private land, you know, and I do. There are parts where I look and go like, it can never be. Like, why can't a tribal corporation look at that and be like, yeah, I kind of like it like that. It's just, there's just something about it. It's just, oh, it kills me. It kills me.
This is just kind of a gripe. We got to bring her back to a point.
Point being, I understand all the complexities and idiosyncrasies and hypocrisies, right? I don't want someone telling me, if someone came and said, hey, man, you can't do that on your property. I'd be like, what? Meanwhile, I look across the beach and I'm like, how can them sons of bitches do that on their property? So it's just like we are full of personal biases and we're always looking out for our own well-being. I could point to you, Hillary, and say, well, you know what? You're running a business. Selling flies to people who are fishing on rivers that flow through private land. You guide clients, right? So you're just looking out for your bottom line, and that's why you're trying to dress up this issue as something that benefits the people when we're really talking about your money.
Right. I just need the money because if it's shut down, I won't get to. But that's a really good point. I mean, that is actually a huge part of it. Look at all of the guides. Look at all of the outfitters who we all work together for our livelihoods. And we all go to the grocery stores, we all send our kids to school, all this, you know, continues on. So it is true. It's a very good point. Looking out for public lands and public access and use is a way of sustaining our families and sustaining our livelihoods, especially in a lot of these small towns where we've got 3 months to do so. So hell yeah, I want to sell the flies. I want to get people on the rivers. And it is a way of looking out for myself.
Can I point out something about the tribal corporation that's clear-cutting the land? They are wonderful about public access. You don't need to ask. You can hunt and fish on their land. Go ahead.
See, that's a weird dichotomy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, it's complicated. It's timber is a renewable resource. My house is built out of wood. That shit got cut down somewhere. Okay? It provides jobs, all that. But we always have these things, but we are always sort of looking out for our personal interests. I'm just trying to make this point. Okay, I'm trying to make this point because I'm trying to say, yes, I'm gearing up to make the point that, yes, I have stuff to gain personally from public access because I like to hunt and fish. But I do think that it's a little bit bigger than my own needs. I think that I'm on the winning side of history when I say that it's something I think we need to do with an eye toward future generations. Roosevelt talked about preserving wildlife. And preserving land for the generations still in the womb of time, the womb of time, okay, beyond us. Because of my occupation, I have no shortage. I could hunt and fish the rest of my life on private property and enjoy the best hunting and fishing the world has to offer, right? I happen to be lucky enough to be like where I doing what I do for work. I have great connections. I don't need this stuff. But I do like to see it because I think about future generations and what will their relationship be to the out of doors? What will their perception of public resources be? Will they have a vested interest? Recently, the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Dan Ash, gave a speech, gave a talk, and what he talked about was conservation becoming irrelevant as people turn away from the out of doors and become more engaged with just electronics, the indoors, as we become more urban and less rural, that people will just not give a shit what happens with the woods and waters. Okay? By enhancing public access and giving people as many opportunities as possible to enjoy the outdoors, to enjoy woods and waters, you increase the likelihood that those same people will stay interested in clean air and clean water. Is the long game. Do I gain something from it on a very personal level on a day-to-day basis? Yes. But I don't think you should take that and turn it against me when I point out that we are talking about something a little bit bigger than catching fish.
Absolutely.
As ourselves.
I do that shorthand. That was a lot more eloquent than I would do it. But I say it's like access is the gateway to, drug to conservation.
Yes.
Right? And so without that access, like what you just said, then why do you care? Right. And so if you have that access and you get out there and you get yourself immersed in it and then you start to learn intersynchronicities of how that all works together and what part you play. So it's just a gateway drug is what it is.
Yeah. Ed Abbey wouldn't have written Desert Solitaire if he didn't hang out outside. Jim Harrison would have written Wolf,
right,
if he hadn't spent a bunch of time in the Huron National Forest. It's like exposure leads to advocacy.
I also guide a lot of people from the city who are trying to get away from their lives, doing whatever it is that they do in the city where you're talking about. Those are kind of potentially the people who might create less need for woods and waters, but they need to get away somehow, right? So they come away for a weekend and they come out and my point to them is, no, I'm glad you came out here to get away, but you need to not come out here to get away. You need to come out here to be part of it because it belongs to you. It belongs to all of us and you need to continue to contribute to it. So this is yours as much as it is mine. This isn't like Disneyland where this river's on rails and you've paid and I'm going to take you around in circles. This belongs to you. So don't think of getting away from it, being in the city and having all your electronics in your life. Make it part of your life. Come out here and say, this is every bit of my life is what I do for my 9 to 5. I mean, yeah, that's the mentality.
Welcome, American, to your river.
To your river. I mean, this is not you getting away. This is an extension of your life and then your kid's life. And when they look at it like that, they're like, oh my God, I never knew. And then that ownership comes out in them. They feel like, God, well, we gotta look at protecting this. This has to be here for future generations. I didn't know this was here for my children's children. And I'm like, how could you not? But now you do. And so then what happens is then they go back to the cities and they can be able to make plans to come back next year. And maybe it will be 2 years, but it doesn't matter. It's in their heart. It's in their head. They're able to tell their kids. They've got their photos. You know, it's the screensaver on their phone now and they're a part of it. And they're going to fight like hell to protect it because they've been there. They're connected to it now.
Yeah.
And they're going to be some of the biggest fighters. And it's soaked in them. They're never going to forget that experience. I mean, I have people who ask for photos of some of our trips that I need to send to them. And it's been maybe years since they've come back, but it's because somebody who was on that trip died and they want that to be part of their memorial service. You know, I mean, it's really lasting impressions and they use it. They're the ones who vote. I mean, any of these guys here will all say that, you know, voting is the number one way that we're going to be able to protect it. And those people in cities who potentially you're saying aren't necessarily connected to it, I think are so connected to it because of their small experiences that they will vote for it.
Good. Now we're going to do something. No. That was great. That was like you did your concluding thought before we do concluding thoughts.
I could say it again.
So you got that's what was worrying me. That's what was worrying me. We'll do concluding thoughts in not the direction you deal poker. Yanni?
Oh, man.
But, Lan, I'm dictating your – that's a punchline to a joke. We recently got really interested in – at my age, I find that punchlines are funnier than the actual joke.
Always.
I'd rather just hear the punchline and try to imagine the joke. Like Yanni's got a punchline, which is funny to me. I know the joke, but I just love the punchline. There's another punchline. Tell him how my dictate. Yanni, tell us your...
No, I don't have any more jokes. I don't have any more punchlines.
My punchlines are too easy.
I'm not going to dictate it to you. Yeah, I am. I'm going to dictate to you that, or I'm going to ask of you that you have your concluding thought dovetail seamlessly into what people can do to find out and get involved. Do you mind doing that?
Whatever
you want to do. But
that was starting to be my concluding thought. So like we were thinking the same thing.
Wiggle it into that.
Okay.
Okay, Yanni.
Like I said before, last time we did a podcast with Land, I had my allies and adversaries mixed up, but we need to find more allies outside of our little bubble, I think, sometimes of hunting and fishing. And I think, like, it's to get more people so the conservation isn't irrelevant, you know? We need to, like, expand and always be accepting and joining hands. And I think everybody knows that new hunters and fishermen and new recreators, sometimes the hardest thing, one of the greatest hurdles we hear about all the time is the is access, you know, where to go, how to get in there, you know, what do I get into it? So I feel like that's where this, you know, makes a lot of sense to me. It's like, let's keep it open. Let's keep it access. Cause that is how we'll get more people into it, you know, and don't be
I hear it all the time, but it's like it doesn't really work. It's utopian.
Why?
There's always people. And I support it. And like I try to help. There's always people who like want to bring in all the stakeholders.
Yeah.
Okay. But you have so many conflicting stakeholders.
But we like can find
the catch and release
ground.
Guys and the harpoon guys. You got like, be like, yes.
Yeah, but if they don't have the water, then it doesn't matter if they catch and release or harpoon.
I know, but I'm saying I love the idea of having all the stakeholders come together. But when they all come together, there's always like a lot of little things to squabble about.
Sure.
I recently was on a thing where like, oh, the Sierra Club. I'm like, yeah, Sierra, I wouldn't really describe, I mean, Sierra Club does some, they do a lot of great stuff. It happens to be that they oftentimes are at odds with hunting.
Sure. And that's my point, is that don't go into that conversation with the member of the Sierra Club thinking that they are immediately at odds at hunting. Tell them the meat eater message, the story. I think a lot of times you'd be surprised that you can sway them and we can be on the same team.
Yeah. No, I support it. I work toward it, but I just am starting to get, I don't know.
No, I just think that too often we're just doing the opposite, though. It's like instead of just being like, oh, it's never going to work, we're already like, screw those greenies. They're not going to help our cause, where maybe they would if you just pitched in the right story, which I think you do all the time, unknowingly, through your words and show and whatnot. Cal, wouldn't you agree with that?
Yeah.
Like you were saying, you showed your wife Meat Eater, right?
Yeah.
She wasn't going to watch a hunting show.
Yeah. She actually liked it.
She liked it?
It's a really good show.
Yeah, cool. Cal, what's your concluding thought? Is that the end of your concluding thought? You wanted him to go, yeah.
And I do say yeah. No, I mean, people need to be involved. People need to be involved, and they need at least some taste to know at least what they're missing out on, and at least a little bit of, you know, people like us, like what makes us so crazy about it. You know, the thing that bugs me about conversations like this is I think a lot of people have a tendency to argue it as an us versus them, a rich versus poor issue.
Yeah, like I was doing earlier.
And I think that's dangerous. That's dangerous to
so
hunting
easy.
And fishing. It is so easy. It is so easy. And
like I'm not. I've studied rhetoric formally, and I know that if you want to win rhetoric, rich versus poor sells.
Yes. There's a lot more of the
and as we learn now, as we learn now in the presidential race, you can do rich versus poor even when you're rich, which is weird.
Yes, but I'm telling you, man, if you go out on a big public waterway and jam a harpoon through the gill plates of a big halibut, and you watch this plume of beautiful red blood come up to the surface.
Yeah, tell me more. I'm following you.
You get so locked into this that you would fight to your dying breath to protect any access, be you a New York State native in a canoe or a Montana fly fisherman, you know, trying to hop over a bridge as a legal access point. Did I wrap that up?
Am I
still floating?
No, you're good.
All right.
Do you want to hit any other points?
Nope, no, sir.
Really?
Are you still getting text messages from the lawyer?
Well, I did today.
Do you want me to call her and talk to her?
Why?
Just to try to patch things up.
No.
Oh.
No. I can make my own bed. I can't do my own laundry, but I can make my own bed.
Hillary, what's your concluding thought?
No, I think that just what Callahan
said is huge.
And I will reiterate his reiteration of what I said, too, is that your connection to it, if it's the big bloody plume, it's nature, it's wildlife, it's the outdoors, you're connected to it. You start to understand by your own experience what access means, you know. And I think that's huge. And I think that, it's something different for everybody, and it's something different wherever you are and however you play. But the more that you can tie your own experience into sharing it with others and passing it on down, then that's when we all start to understand it a little bit better.
Good. I'm going to come back to you in a minute.
You think I have something more to say?
No, my concluding thought is a question.
Okay.
Okay. I'm gonna skip out of turn because I want to end with your deal. Wait. Here's my concluding thought. If you're as a guide, let's say you take a client out and you take them down a stretch of river. And you're like, here's what's up. Here's where the fish like to lay. Here's what we're getting them on right now. Do this, do that. Don't bother there. I know that hole looks just like that hole, but for whatever reason, there's no fish in this hole. Go fish that hole. And then the next day, there he is. Do you get pissed?
No.
Or are you happy?
I'm happy. No, I'm not kidding.
But are you not? Is that a normal guide feeling or a not normal guide feeling?
Yeah. So I know what you're talking about because there are guides that I've been to different places. You know, I fish all over the country and everything. And there's places I go where I genuinely, sincerely have no idea what happens in that fishery. And I step up and they can tell I'm going to ask them what they're using, what flies they're using. It'll cover up the fly that they have on their rod with their hand. They don't want me to see it. You know, or else sometimes guides always talk about how the flies in your hat up here, these flies up in my hat, this is actually what I'm fishing. But there's lots of places you go where they intentionally put
I like that.
The wrong fly in their hat to make you think as a visitor, that's what you use. And then you're the dork out there, you know, throwing big chubbies and that's not what they're using. You're using tiny PMDs, you know. So it's like it does exist, what you're talking about. However, where I live in Glacier Country, we have a lot to share. So it's not just the rivers and the fish.
So honestly don't care?
No, I don't care.
There he is the next day standing in the hole.
Yeah.
And you're like, why do I know this guy?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Oh, that I guided him here yesterday.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, what's
like,
up?
He's going to have giardia in a few hours anyways. No, I'm just kidding. No,
you're talking to a gal with incredible wealth and knowledge of the area, though, too. Some, you know, greenhorn comes in and goes to the spot where he caught the fish.
He's not going to catch a fish.
He's going to catch fish in that, but, you know, he's got a lot to learn.
Yeah, I get it. They don't know.
Hillary's still going to do just fine.
Yeah,
it was more of I'm not asking because I want to understand her perspective. I'm asking just to understand this thing I'm plotting out in my head, and I'm just curious.
No, and
I'm plotting the thing out in my head.
I know exactly.
And I'm trying to weigh how unethical it is to do what I want to do. And I was just seeking some opinion from a guide.
No, I personally have no
problem
with
that. I might go screw a guide over.
No, I mean, there's typical.
All you guys out there. Yeah. I'm lurking.
FYI, this is what I look like. Can't see me. No, I mean, there's definitely ethics involved, but that isn't one of the things that bugs me, and it happens all the time. You know, and a lot of times, to be real honest, take it a step further, people will come into my shop, and they'll book a trip with me, and then I'll draw them a map for the next day. literally, and give them the flies for the next day because I want them to do it right. I don't want them to go out there and do it wrong. So if they book a trip
so
with
you'll
me,
say they fish with you on Monday.
Yeah.
They're still in town.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, here's what you ought to do tomorrow.
Yeah, you bet. And it's going to be legit. Like, it's super serious. I'm not going to send them in the wrong spot. I'm not going to send them where I want them to go because that's not where the fish are, anything like that. It's really, really sincere and honest. And the reason is because I know what I'm talking about and I want them to do it right. I don't want them to, you know, mess it up out there. I want them to go out there with as much knowledge on their own that I can give them in my boat. And I really do, again, maybe it's Pollyanna, but I feel like most of the guide community is the same way. We want to educate people about the fishery. We don't want them sore mouthing fish. We want them taking care of the fish. We don't want them, you know, to not pinch their barbs. We want barbs pinched. We want them to have fun so that they come back and experience it. We don't want to send them out.
Or stand on private land.
Yeah, or stand on private land or make a mess. Like, we want them to have a freaking blast. Like, we do. We really sincerely do. And so, no, it does not bother me when I see somebody out there publicly fishing a place that I've guided them previously, or I also don't look at them and go, oh, those could be my dollars. Like, I could have taken them today. You know, I think that rising tide floats all boats, getting more people out there. And when I say more people, I'm not advocating for crazy pressure on these rivers. I'm saying that the more public access we have, the more spread out we can be. If we start to pinch ourselves down by limiting public access, then that's going to happen. That's going to start to happen. I've seen it in Utah all the time. I get high hold and low hold by people, and by guides, actually, in Utah all the time.
Explain that to me.
High hold and low hold?
Yeah.
So many holes. So yeah. There's, if you're fishing and somebody drops in on you, same kind of goes in where you are, and then they go above you and you're working your way up, maybe.
Oh.
And then they steal that hole, that's, you're getting high hold, and then same thing for when you're getting low hold. And in boats, it's real easy to low hold somebody else. You pass them, and you can drop in on them. And a lot of times, that's ethically okay because you're leapfrogging.
Yep.
You kind of like get into this rhythm where you can leapfrog in boats, and it can be okay. But if you're both anchored up and fishing, and then you get ready to go, and they drop in before you,
yep.
You know, that can be low holding you too. You're getting ready to go, and they look over their shoulder and see you, and then push, and go, and they're kind of low-holing you. So it can happen on foot, and it can happen in the boat or whatever, and that's just regular guide ethics, but it happens more when there's less public access, because now you are in a battle.
Yeah.
And now I am racing against the clock and on fish and like trying to get, you know, my people happy. And I think that just recreational fishing on foot, that's when the fights happen. That's when people are like, this is my water, because now you're pinched. In Utah, when we've got 1 mile we can fish in a certain stretch and you've got six people all just low-holing each other, then that gets real tense, you know. And you're not going to catch fish because people are tromping all over the place. So that's what happens when we have less area.
Not a real good outdoor experience.
No,
at that point.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you this question. One day I was fishing and wading and I come around a corner and there's a guide. He's got his little pick, you know, they set up those little tables. The client's there and they got like wine out. It's just like absurd. So they're having like the little shore lunch, cheese and crackers, right?
Oh, yeah.
And he's camped out on this hole. And on my way up, wading up, I fish the hole where he's camped out having his lunch. And this guy goes ballistic. Out of line or not out of line?
You know, I might be different about this. Not out of line for me. I mean, like, for me, again, I swear to God, I would invite you to come up and have some wine with us. You know, I mean, that's just. Because
we got in a screaming.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Not out of line for me. No, it's like, it's not, we're taking a break. Like,
and he was in a boat.
Yeah.
I could see that conversation happening at the bar if you bumped into each other later on.
That's part two of
the
story.
With your clients on the shore.
Yeah. In front of his clients.
Absolutely.
Part two of the story is we wound up drinking in the same bar.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend was a bartender in the bar, and he had a girlfriend who was a bartender in the bar, and we wound up hashing it out later in a much more friendly way and agreed to disagree. He said, no way. He goes, you don't know that I have fished it, am going to fish it, I'm holding the hole.
No, that's not a thing. You can't hold a hole.
That guy's from out of state.
No, that guy's not.
In Montana, that guy's from
out of state.
There is no holding the hole. No, let the hole be free.
I hope that son of a bitch is listening.
No, and I'm sure he is, and he's changing his ways right this second.
He's like, man, you know what? That thing that happened 12 years ago, dude.
Yeah. No, but if you came to Montana right now, I think, you know, where we fish and stuff, that's not a thing.
You don't hold the hole.
No, you don't. It's ridiculous. You don't stick a stake in it and fly your flag.
No. Because the only reason you're pulling the thing is because it's public.
I want to tell the whole Holden story. Do you know what time we started, Johnny?
Yep.
About wrapping it up time?
Yep.
Doggone it. Well, real quick. We used to fish Great Lakes Whitefish in the Sioux Edison Hydroelectric Dam. And there's like 42 turbines. And for whatever reason, turbine number 27 would get a lot of fish in it. And old men like to fish it. And they would get up very, very early and go tie off. That's where the water comes out of the turbine. There's, for whatever reason, these studs in the ceiling. You could tie a rope around the stud and hold yourself right in the outflow turbine and drift flies for whitefish. We would go to the bar and close the bar, then get in our boat and go sleep in the turbine. And that would be very irritating to people who would get up at 5.
Yes.
And we were just sleeping in sleeping bags in the bottom of a boat holding the hole. That would lead to some cross looks.
That is hero hole holding.
Yes.
That is.
Lan?
I've learned a lot of new terms today. Hero hole holding is the newest one.
Remember what I asked.
Yeah, no. I think part of my concluding thought is I think this piece about us versus them, you know, and I think we all lose when that happens. And whether that's rich versus poor or private landowners versus the unwashed public, I think we lose. And
who loses?
I think we all lose.
America.
America loses, really.
Yeah.
And I think one thing that that anglers can do a better job of, Hillary brought it up, being stewards, but it's also not being bad actors. You know, we talk about the garbage that gets left at places or letting your dogs run. I mean, that's all stuff that we can control on our end to make sure that those relationships stay better.
And alleviate tension.
Alleviate tension. And I think another thing that Hillary brought up is knocking on doors. And even though you know that there's public access there, and you can legally access it, letting them know that you're going to be there is just one of these friendly things that I think we're getting away from in this society. And, you know, I rode down the plane from Missoula and sat next to a guy who's a landowner, and we were talking about this issue. And he said, you know, I have a place down in southwest Montana, and above my house, about a mile, there's a river access site. Below my house, there's a river access site. And people are trespassing all the time through my property. And when I go out and try to have a normal conversation with them and be, hey, there's legal access upriver and downriver, and then you can wade back and forth all you want, we get in a big yelling, screaming match about, no, this is my river and I have stream access. And so that, to me, that story gets told by that landowner to another landowner, and then that is that way for another 10, 15 years, that one story. So I think we can be better actors as just anglers in general. And so that's a segue into then knowing what the laws are, right? And we've talked about some of the differences, and I'll just take, you know, Montana, Wyoming and Colorado is just a difference. In Montana, where we have great stream access, you know, I can access up to the high water mark. I go down to Wyoming or Colorado, and we've talked about it. If my anchor's in the water, I'm trespassing. I can't really wade at all on private land. Know the laws, and so that you know that. I think we've talked about how in Montana, private landowners don't have to post their land for trespassing. Know the law.
It's
the user responsibility. Know the law. And so as backcountry hunters and anglers, that's what we're trying to do with our Stream Access Now campaign first, is just create awareness. And so, one, you keep yourself legal. And so, you know, when I go to another state and I'm over a bridge and I see some awesome, sexy water, I want to go access that. But I got to know the law before I jump and put my toe in. One, because I can get in a lot of trouble in the position I'm in. But two, that's just a good thing for me to know. So that the first one is just knowing what I think the laws are. But then as something Cal said, is that if you don't know what you have, then why are you going to try to stand up and defend it? So that's one. If you don't know that things can be better, then why would you work to try to make them better? And so by understanding the differences of stream access laws all across this country and what it is for you in your own state, you can decide on whether that's a place where you want to try to make it better or if it's something you want to hold on to. So I think that education piece is gigantic. And as confusing as some of this stuff was today, and I appreciate you keep on bringing that back and, whoa, let's slow down and explain this, is because this stuff gets complicated really quickly. And so what we're trying to do is create a place where you have one place to go, where you know what is legal, what is not, and how to find that information. We're compiling that right now. And
state by state.
State by state. And nobody's ever done that before.
What's stream access like in Hawaii?
I will tell you, here in December, okay. I'm going, actually, my mother-in-law turned 70. And believe it or not, on Kauai, there are natural occurring, and not natural, but they planted them, but now they're naturally reproducing rainbow trout on Kauai.
Ugh.
Which is going to be absolutely crazy to go fish these little teeny streams with a guide first, I'm going to try to figure it out for myself so I can do it maybe one or two other days.
And go to their honey holes.
Go to their honey holes and be sitting on there. I'm going to hole hole in them and hold them and whatever. I'll be a hero hold holder. I'll be a howly hero hold holder. So I think it's that education piece first. And then second, like there's like we've heard about a couple of them already, but down in Utah, the Utah Stream Access Coalition, Montana, it's really the Public Land Water Access Association. There's these groups that are kind of starting to build coalitions in these states. And so we want to, one, help amplify their voices. And in places like New Mexico, where they just lost a bill by 4 votes in their state legislature that restricted stream access, we want to make sure there's a coalition. So the next time that we have an opportunity to get that law changed, that we have people coming together. And so that's happening in New Mexico. And so we want to, you know, we can't be all places all the time. What we can be is facilitators and amplify voices, right? And so we're trying to educate and motivate and then inspire people to do stuff. So Stream Access Now is this campaign. We've had an awesome corporate partner. I mean, Hillary talked about how, you know, this is a huge piece of business, right? If you don't have access, this whole fishing industry pretty much goes away. And yes, there will still be people fishing, but it won't be as robust and sustainable as it is right now. And so, you know, Yeti has stepped up, Costa, Fish Pond, Sage, Reddington, Fly Lines. Women in Montana's making awesome little lanyards out of used fly line. So, like, the industry Fly Vines. The industry understands it. And then I think the public is starting to understand it, but they need to be educated about it. And that's really what we're doing.
There you have it. Is there like a website?
Stream Access Now. You can go to this
.org.
You can also find it through our backcountryhuntersandanglers.org site. We have it on there as well.
All right, folks.
Stream Access Now.
Next time you find yourself buzzing along fishing walleye and you realize that you got a golf course on one side and a house on the other, think about it. Stay tuned in. All right. Thank you guys very much, man.
Thank you. Perfect.